The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Can we turn it around? I may have to change my theme song, my wonderful music from J.P. Taylor. I always thought we could if we got people to wake up and get active on board. It will take all hands on deck starting yesterday, and we're not quite there yet. And then I heard this talk. It was chilling, stunning, in fact, on Saturday. I'm going to tell you about that and then tell you about our guest who's going to share with all of you what I learned, which is it's later than we think, and it may be too late even to hope for renewable energy to save us and get us out of this pickle we're in, pickle being a very nice light term for what otherwise sounds like could be a very dire future. Either way, we need to wake up and accept reality, look at the facts, look at the trends, look at the science, look at the graphs. Well, that's what happened at this presentation that I was fortunate enough to hear. As disturbing as it was, I'm one for dealing with reality and don't have that ability to deny like so many people seem to have that gene. I got a different gene, and probably if you're listening to this program, you're more like me, and that is to take in what the experts are telling us. And there's some experts looking at peak oil, and not only have we perhaps peaked in terms of our oil consumption, these folks certainly think so, but the second half is not going to be nearly as lengthy and luxurious as the first half of getting to peak oil in terms of available oil and its accessibility and its affordability. What am I talking about? Well, let me just back up a little bit and tell you about this excellent seminar series that I'm lucky enough to be taking part in, but you can perhaps access it via some of the interviews I'll be doing and some of the websites and organizations that the speakers that are speaking to us through the Environmental Forum of Marin are associated with. So the Environmental Forum of Marin has been around for 35 years, and I've been living in the Bay Area all that time for the most part and have been aware of this great program, and they teach mostly adults who are out there working or looking for a way to recycle their careers, maybe for a second career, or just because they are interested in environmental issues, but not just locally, you know, in Marin County, but really looking at it from a national and global perspective, as well as some local issues. So I've never had time to take the series, which runs on all-day Tuesdays, I think, for 6 to 9 months, have thought about it, wanted to, but they have sort of put the series into a seminar version. It's kind of the best of, and it's on steroids in terms of its impact, and it's also, as one of the organizers, Nancy Bell, put it, it's not sugarcoating the environmental challenges that we're facing. When I heard that from Nancy a few weeks ago, I decided it's time for me to take this course. It is on Saturday mornings on the weekend, not ideal, but it is worth every moment, because what I'm learning, and I've been interviewing environmental leaders for about 13 years, so I think I'm pretty up to date on the Green Front and like to keep you abreast. That's why I call my program The Green Front, is in reporting from the green front lines with innovators from across the green spectrum. But what I learned on Saturday stunned me, so much so that I have to share it with you. I also have to say it's pretty disturbing, because as much as we all know that there's a lot of work to be done, in a way, part of this message is it's kind of too late. And what does that mean for us, and what do we do about that information? But we're going to find out exactly, you know, what is the reasoning, what is the rationale behind this conclusion that, you know, it really is later than we think. And to do that, I am very pleased to introduce Asher Miller. He is the executive director of the Post-Carbon Institute, and Ken White, their development director, is the one who gave us a presentation, and very excited to meet for the first time over the radio, Asher Miller, who works just north of where I live in Marin County, up in Sonoma County. They're doing fabulous work up there, and thanks and welcome to the Green Front, Asher.
Thanks. It's nice to meet you, Betsy.
So, you know, we'll just cut to the chase here. And I just watched a 5-minute video, animation video, that is excellent. So if anybody would like to know what we're talking about, they should go to your website, which I'm sure you'll give out all the links to. It's just well done. And 5 minutes, anyone can take 5 minutes and get up to date on what we're facing. And you did it in a very, it was like on speed, and you have to kind of catch your breath watching it, but it's worth watching a second and third time, because the way you lay it out there, it all makes sense, and it shows us how we got here over the last 300 years and 300 seconds of using fuels. It's foolish to ignore where we've come from and where you say we're headed. But anyway, that's a great tool, because it's interesting, and it's disturbing, as I said, and it's a big wake-up call. So give us a little bit of background first to share about the Post-Carbon Institute and the work you've been doing there, and perhaps why your message is just so urgent and more relevant than ever today.
Sure. Well, Post-Carbon Institute has been around since 2003, and originally the organization was formed up in Vancouver, British Columbia, actually, because the founders of the organization, I think, went through a similar process than maybe that you just experienced last weekend, in that when they became aware of, peak oil and the consequences of peak oil, they sort of caught their hair on fire. And the organization's been working ever since that time, I think, to try to create awareness about that issue, but also looking at sort of the interconnections between constraints in energy supply and then environmental issues in the economy. What Post-Carbon Institute does these days is try to show how those interconnections, we call them the four E's, looking at the intersections between the economy, the environment, energy issues, and equity issues. And our approach is to try to bring the sort of the best thinking together to see how these issues are interrelating and influencing one another, with the recognition, I think, that you can't really tackle one of these issues in isolation. And there's so many, for example, just within the environmental sphere, there's so many environmental issues that people are wrestling with, and there are a lot of amazing organizations and individuals who are on a crusade to try to tackle these things, whether they're doing it in their backyard, they're trying to do it on a national, international level, in terms of protecting species or wildlife habitats or, the mother of all environmental issues, climate change. But you can't really tackle those issues without seeing how it's all related to our dependence upon fossil fuels, and also to realize that our economy is completely predicated on the need to be constantly growing our energy base, constantly growing our throughput in terms of resource use. So for us, what we did was try to say, okay, well, what are the best minds doing in each of these areas? Who are the folks out there that are thinking very deeply about how to tackle these issues, but they're looking at it from a systemic perspective? So we have 29 fellows. We could easily have double that number or triple that number. But the 29 fellows that we did end up recruiting are folks that are, deeply versed in one of these areas or a number of these areas, but also see sort of the bigger picture. We actually went out and recruited these folks. A lot of maybe your listeners will be familiar with some of these people. Bill McKibben, for example, is one of our fellows.
Oh, yes, a regular on the Green Front. And, of course, right. Richard Heinberg is one of my all-time favorite guests, and he's working on a book. I'm very excited to
read that. Richard's our senior fellow. But we've got people who are experts on food and water and population issues, and as I mentioned, economic issues. We even have two doctors who are public health experts. What we've been doing is working with our fellows to sort of say, okay, well, where are we right now? The exercise that we went through with them recently ended up being turned into a book, which we called The Post-Carbon Reader, that just came out a few months ago. And the attempt there was to sort of say, okay, well, what's happening in each of these areas? What are sort of the limits that we're hitting or experiencing in each of these areas? How are they all interrelated to one another? And then what's the response? And for us as an organization, we don't feel like things are too late. I do think that we try to bring a certain realism about the severity of the situation that we're in particularly when it comes to looking at, alternative paths away from, the path that we're on, business as usual in terms of its impacts on climate, is just really understanding the unique role that energy plays and fossil fuels have played. So we need to have a certain sort of realism about that. And I think this for some people it might sound like sort of a semantic difference, but we really try to focus on responses, not solutions. And the reason that we make that distinction is that we believe, and this is not our own language, this is, you know, language that we've gotten from others, that we're faced with a predicament, not a problem. A problem is something that you go and try to, you know, fix and solve, right? You figure out what, how you solve that problem, you solve it, and it's over. A predicament is something that you have to deal with, you know, and that's what we're dealing with here. There are no magic, you know, silver bullets in the equation for us, and there are a lot of things that we can do, a lot of things we need to do, but to think that we're going to magically solve our way out of sort of the mess we're in, I think, is unfortunately, you know, underestimating the severity of the problem, or the predicament, I guess I should say, that we're dealing with.
And yet the majority of Americans and many of our politicians, you know, still believe we're the country of American can-do and innovation and ingenuity, and we're going happily along, and the economy's coming back, and jobs are coming back, and SUV sales are up, and yet we're kind of heading off a cliff. How do you just reconcile what you know in the work that you do with, you know, people out there being kind of blissfully unaware? Not that there isn't information out there. You know, mainstream media is certainly starting to cover climate change and ocean threats, you know, on a more regular basis, still not close to the, you know, scale needed, especially when it comes to broadcast. Don't get me started there. My personal passion to get a green talk show on national radio or television airways. You'd think we might need one given the prognosis
sure,
here.
Yeah.
So how do you, we're going to go much more deeply, I'm so glad you're with us for most of the hour, into, you know, what are all the factors leading up to this, you know, situation that we're going to talk about. But just, I'm just wondering personally how you deal with the dissonance, you know, extreme cognitive dissonance that you must
yeah.
feel in your workday life and then going out there in quote, the real world, seeing a lot of, you know, smiling people talking about things like, you know, what happened on the job that day and their latest diet and what they're doing this weekend and the Super Bowl.
Sure.
Real life, normal life.
Well, you know, I'm glad you actually brought that up because I think if we don't understand the personal sort of dynamic here and how people's minds work and how we live our lives, I don't think that we can really respond to this at all. You know, I consider myself an environmentalist, and a lot of our peers and allies are ones in the environmental space, but I think the environmentalists, you know, have made a mistake in thinking that we function as rational beings, you know, and that when people are presented with information, they make the right choices. The truth of the matter is, as you described it, you know, we are dealing with cognitive dissonance, and that includes, I would put myself squarely in that camp, you know. I have a life, I've got two small kids, you know, busy trying to, you know, make ends meet and take care of everything on a daily basis. And then, you know, there's this looming reality, that I feel actually privileged to be aware of. It's also an obligation, I guess, to be aware of. But, you know, how do you reconcile
this? It's a mixed blessing, isn't it? On the one hand,
yeah,
you do
sure.
feel like you have information, which, as not to interrupt you for more than a second here, but Andre Angelantano from the Post-Peak Living Institute, who's going to join us next week, and his presentation along with Ken White's, he said it has made him, this knowledge that he, you know, is aware of and works on every day, has made him appreciate the food that we have, the abundance,
sure,
the variety,
yeah.
Basically all the riches we have that we will not have, according to these, you know, models, you know, going forward even as early as a decade from now. So that's the richness that it adds and the sense of, you know, preciousness. I asked him if he had children, and he doesn't, so I'm happy to hear you do. I also am the mother of not a small child. She's a 16-year-old, and that's the downside. I am, you know, despairing for her future and everyone else's. I see pregnant women walking around, Cher, and I almost want to go up to them and say, have you not heard? And not that I'd want to talk them out of it, heavens no, but when you think that most people are thinking generations are going to go on just like we've been living, you know, and have no awareness apparently of what we're, you know, about to face. So it's about to hit us in the face. It really is. It's a mixed blessing. Sorry to go on about that, but just
sure,
acknowledging
well,
what you're saying.
Well, I think, you know, I heard someone use a metaphor that actually worked really well for me, and that was, you know, it's basically for those of us, I think, who are aware of these deep fundamental sustainability issues and the fact that we're, you know, as one of our fellows, Chris Morrison, describes it, you know, the next 20 years are going to be very different than the last. And being aware of that, I think, you know, we're sort of on, We have one leg on one moving walkway and another leg on the other, in the sense that, you know, the world still functions pretty effectively. For those of us here, at least, you know, we're lucky enough to live in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have a lot of creature comforts, a lot of benefits, you know, being...
Like gorgeous weather, just getting more gorgeous with climate
exactly.
change, while the rest of the country is still digging yeah. out from, you know, epic blizzasters.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and just we have access. I mean, you can just run to the grocery store, you know, anytime you need to pick something up. I mean, we have immense bounty, you know, and things are functioning quite well, at least for us, you know. And I'm obviously speaking relatively here. So, how do we deal with the fact that that reality might be very different? And I have this moment a lot, which is, you know, going to the grocery store, for example, you know, and walking around there and thinking, you know, most grocery stores, you know, I don't go to Safeway all that often, but when I do go there, I think, you know, about their just on time sort of delivery system, you know, and most of these stores have got maybe 24 or 48 hours worth of food stock available, you know, and it just takes one little event in this very long supply chain to cause disruptions, you know, and you don't have to be, you know, a doomish sort of, you know, apocalypse believing person to think that, well, you know, if we had a big earthquake, we had some kind of natural disaster, you know, that just-in-time delivery system, you know, could really suffer some kind of breakage. You know, what do we
do
then?
We had a power outage a couple of years ago. I think the power was out for 4 or 5 days, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
Maybe it was longer ago than that, but my daughter was young. She's a teenager now, so maybe it was more like 10 years ago. I don't know. But it was, you know, we went out and got lanterns, and it changed, you know, just the scenery, the landscape, the hue of daily life so radically. And suddenly you could see how things can change in an instant here. We do
right.
worry about major earthquakes and more
yeah.
intense weather. And yet it's so easy to just feel like everything is going to continue as it has been. And really that's what a lot of this is based on, our assumptions, right, that we have unlimited
sure.
resources and that unlimited growth is a good thing.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the thing, and I'm glad you brought that up. I think Rebecca Solnes, this really interesting book that just came out recently, which is really about the resilience in the community that's formed in extreme situation disasters. I think the title is A Paradise Built in Hell, you know. And she talks about examples, historical examples, even recent examples where, you know, communities go through massive shocks, whether it's an earthquake like the 1906 earthquake here, you know, or Hurricane Katrina or other, you know, horrible events. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more of these and will be seeing more and more of these with climate disruptions. But it's not to put a rosy picture on it, but we tend to have this horrible vision of how society breaks down in those situations, and it's true that this can definitely tend to happen, but it also, like I think you were alluding to, when you strip away the veneer of some of this stuff, you sort of get to what really matters, you know, and where I have hope is I think that we as a species we're pretty resilient, we're pretty adaptive, you know, we survived and have thrived as a species. Maybe for a short period of time in evolutionary history, but, you know, we figured out a way to become the dominant species on this planet, and part of that was our ability to adapt, you know. So there's an ability that I think that we have to adjust to those things and realize kind of what our core values are, what are the things that really matter to us when you strip away some of those things, you know. But the flip side of that is that we are very bad and making long-term decisions, you know. And one of our fellows, a guy named Peter Weibrow, he's a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist at UCLA, and he does a lot of work looking at human evolutionary behavior based upon sort of the evolution of the brain, you know. And most of our, you know, our evolutionary history and the way that our brain functions, the decisions we make, are really, you know, very old, evolutionarily speaking. And so we're not really, you know, they have something called steep discount rate. So if you go to somebody and you say, hey, would you like a massage, you know, an hour-long massage right now, or do you want a two-hour massage next, you know, tomorrow? Most people would have probably picked a one-hour massage right now, you know, because the further away something is, the more that we discount it. You know, and that's why it's very difficult with issues like climate change and other things that are systemic, large-scale issues that people have been warning us about. You know, we've been warned about climate change since the 80s, you know, and it's always being presented as something that's for future generations, you know. And I actually think that doesn't work from a messaging standpoint, You know,
not for Americans. We're very impatient. We want it now.
Yeah.
We, you know, instant gratification. And yet we are such good deniers. My God, I've been just amazed that we're world class. You know, the rest of the world is getting it much faster than we are. And I mean, it makes sense. I'm joking, but historically, sociologically, we have had a sense of entitlement. We have had this incredible, phenomenal growth built on, you know, discovering fossil fuels. And yet that's the problem, right? Is we're seeing the dark side, the downside to this incredible ascent of development and growth and progress. We're seeing the problems, and we've seen them for some time. You know, we've heard, you know, certainly murmurings, and environmentally tuned in people have been reading about it for 10, 20 years, but it seems like we're just reaching this critical mass where all these ecological systems are in decline. And you know, if you're in boxes like mine, and it's probably worse on steroids, you know, it's just there's so much bad news. And yet you walk out there, and it's still difficult for me to even get my non-green friends. I'm not saying they're anti-environment, they're just, you know, not my friends who the environmental community and the work I do, to really understand what, you know, we're talking about. So how do we cross that divide?
Well, I actually have a lot of empathy, you know, for people in that situation, because, you know, it's
to get other people to relate,
well,
or for those
empathy
people
for both
who
sides.
Don't know. I think ignorance is bliss in some ways.
Yeah, no, but I have empathy for both sides, because I think, you know, it's very difficult to hold on to the weight of this, you know, and it's funny because we're one of our new advisors, a man named Sanjay Khanna, does a lot of work on psychosocial resilience, basically, you know, and looking at the psychological impacts of climate change, and also, you know, economic hardships. And something that he's been looking a lot at, you know, he went to the big meeting in Copenhagen at the end of 2009, you know, which a lot of environmental groups were ramped up for and were really hopeful that, you know, with Obama being elected, that the time was sort of right for international diplomatic efforts to get serious, you know. And he was there sort of as a witness to see how these groups were doing. And there's a huge turnout of environmental groups and a lot of young people there. And, you know, they were just totally dismayed at the response that they got. They were basically told to their face that they weren't large enough. You know, there wasn't big enough of a movement to put pressure on, you know, these international leaders, including our own government, to take this issue seriously, you know. And so what he's looked a lot at is how do you deal, somebody be on the front lines, with the weight of that, you know. And we carry a lot of weight. Those of us who are aware of these issues and concerned about these issues, we carry weight to change our own behavior. We carry weight to try to somehow convince others to change their behavior. You know, but I think it's really important for us to realize that, you know, for all of us, we're all guilty. You know, I'm a hypocrite, just like the next guy, you know, and it's important to understand the limitations of changing behavior, you know, with this information. I deal with this all the time, because it was very humbling to me as somebody who was really working on trying to make, before I started working at Post Carbon Institute, I was doing work to try to make it easy and rewarding and fun for people to change their behavior around climate, you know. And there was a big, you know, I would say a big effort, a creative effort on the part of a lot of really well-intentioned people to try to figure out, you know, what are the right, you know, behavioral triggers, the right motivations to get people to become greener in their lifestyles, you know. And a lot of that was focused on making it sort of positive and talking about the benefits of doing it. And, you know, and I was very involved in all that work. And it wasn't until sort of the summer of 2008 when oil prices, you know, went sky high, it was $147 a barrel. You know, gas prices here in California were, you know, Northern California, $4.50 higher in some places, that I really saw in my own community. And, you know, here I am in Sonoma County, which tends to be a pretty, you know, progressive and green community. You know, that's when I really actually saw people changing their behavior. You know, that's
when
I saw people getting up.
Well, I had Colin Devon on
No
Impact Man. Sorry, I had No Impact Man on about a month ago. And, you know, he writes about this incredible cognitive dissonance created by finally wanting to stop whining about, you know, wondering about the future for his young daughter and doing something about it. And it seems that the finding ways to eat within 250, you know, miles of his home as far as where the food came from, and even turning off the electricity, that was relatively easy compared to the more he learned, trying to figure out what he was going to do after this year of having no impact, you know, ended. You know, is he going to go back to, you know,
sure,
a normal lifestyle, realizing how hard it is, how little impact each of us have, and yet how important it is that each of us take this on in whatever way we can and as quickly as we can.
Well, that's the good news and the bad news. Here, the bad news is that in some ways, and I think this will probably make some people bristle for me to say, in some ways, this is all a moot point. You know, I think all the effort that's gone into trying to convince people based on moral arguments or trying to make, you know, economic arguments, you know, to get people to fundamentally change behavior, whether it's policy-oriented or just on an individual basis, you know, a lot of that has gone for naught. And it's kind of a moot point in the sense that, so because of that, you know, there were, I mean, as you probably know, I mean, in the early 70s, there was a report book that came out, which is the biggest selling environmental book of all time called Limits to Growth, you know, and that basically predicted all the stuff that we're dealing with now, you know, and it was vilified at the time, because I think people, who were really promoters of sort of business as usual, saw it as a threat, you know. And so when you talk to people now, a lot of people who I think were sort of up on the news at the time, and you talk about the Club of Rome, you know, and they might roll their eyes, you know, like if you talk about the population bomb, you know, mm-hmm. sort of as something discredited. But when you look back at it now, people have done this, where they've done updates of this, you know, repeatedly since that point, and others have looked into it, and pretty much all the, and they weren't really predictions, they were more like looking at trends, are spot on. You know, that was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, warning people, you know, that we're going to hit a wall at some point. Well, guess what? The wall is here, you know? So, and the good news, I guess, about all that, that's a lot of bad news, but the good news about all that is that this is not a debate anymore. This is not about that. You know, and it's not about being greener, you know, and some people having a holier than thou attitude one way or the other. This is about how we're going to get through this bottleneck that we're dealing
with. Well, exactly.
With.
It, you know, it's always struck me as, you know, how we're mocked, those of us who are concerned about this, as being, you know, virtuous, tree huggers, whatever. It's not a luxury anymore. This is not something that people can decide they're either into or not. And since we haven't really woken up as a nation fast enough, and we are so good at pushing it aside, it seems that we're going to get this giant wake-up call pretty quickly coming up here, where it's going to be kind of somewhat dark and stark, and that's unfortunate. I mean, if you look at history, as you so brilliantly did in that 300-second history of fossil fuel use, you see that this is relatively recent. You know, this is all coming up pretty quickly on us, and yet we're going to have to change so fast in terms of really getting our arms wrapped around this reality that you present with your, you know, work at the Institute, that I just I wonder how this is going to happen, when this is going to happen, because it's still, you know, those who are tuned in, relatively, you know, small percentage of the American public compared to everyone else. And I guess what I'm trying to say is how can we spread the green gospel quickly, widely, loudly, without, you know, going from denial to despair, you know, that
sure.
sweet spot in the middle,
yeah.
which is where we should be now. And yet, if you look on, you know, just radio waves, 95% of all talk shows are conservative right-wing nuts who say we don't have a problem. So we're so opposite of where we need to be in terms of just media, public, legislature, even the White House really leading us out of this or into this crisis, you know, full eyes wide open, full bore. And I don't know, what's it going to take?
I think it's going to take being forced, frankly. You know, I mean, and that's maybe a cynical view, you know, but and it's, I think it's important, you know, there's a distinction for those of us who are kind of sort of steeped in this, in this crisis, you know, the energy crisis, the environmental crisis, and actually the economic crisis too, which I'd be happy to talk about as well. But those of us sort of steeped in this, I think there's lots of debate about how, you know, and within the peak wealth community, for example, and, you know, I'm one person, so I don't want to represent an entire group of people, but, you know, there are outcome, the results of this sort of gap that we're going to experience between, in the availability of cheap oil and cheap energy, and an economy and an entire system, you know, transportation system, our food system, everything can be completely dependent upon the availability and use of cheap petroleum and other fossil fuels. You know, that gap, when we hit that, it literally will be like hitting a wall, you know, and they have this sort of, you know, image of kind of a bit of an apocalypse kind of image of, you know, breakdown of social order and all kinds of things happen. And then there are others, I think, who sort of see this as, you know, in some ways more of a utopian vision, you know what I mean, of the fact that, you know, communities will come together and that we don't need this stuff anyway, and that the sort of consumer-based, you know, globalized, you know, economy that we built is not good for the people of the planet anyway, and so everything's going to be better afterwards, you know.
Well, there's a big gap in between those two scenarios.
And I think the truth is in between that, you know what I mean? And uh-huh. And when societies go through, they go through constraints, they go through some fundamental driver that forces a shift in them, you know, sure, there could be events, a natural disaster, some kind of trigger event that means that there's a radical shift that happens. But more often than not, we're talking about a, you know, this more gradual, if you want to call it decline or gradual change, you know. So I think I think we ought to sort of take a deep breath, you know, and say that, that we can run around panicked, and we should be very alarmed and very concerned, you know. But the way that these things are all going to unfold is very hard to predict. And that's why we really push this concept of building resilience. You know, the resilience is really about, you know, for an individual or for a community, is about having the ability to withstand shocks, particularly shocks that you can't always predict, and kind of maintain your fundamental character. You know what I mean? And when you think about your fundamental character, when you're thinking about that as an individual or a family or a community, what is our fundamental character? You know, and you're right that a lot of us here in the United States have this sort of sense of entitlement and a belief that we've equated things. You know, a lot of people equate capitalism with democracy, for example. You know, a lot of people equate being able to buy a lot of consumer goods with happiness. You know, there's these things that we've done that where we've conflated things together, you know. But that's actually, you know, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, the animation that we put together that you were referencing, you know, talks a little bit about that. But, you know, sort of the big push sort of post-World War II around sort of advertising and marketing to go buy stuff, you know. You know, that's, even within U.S. history, that's kind of a short period of time. And there's another story there. There's a story of how people came together, you know, during the Great Depression and World War II, you know. And in our office, for example, we have all these posters, these World War II era posters, you know, posters about conservation, posters about growing your own food. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we talk about is the stuff that they were talking about then, that people did sort of voluntarily. I mean, yes, the government was very involved in actually using propaganda to communicate those things, you know, as part of the war effort, but people did it. You know, people were recycling, people were conserving, people were growing their own. I mean, and, you know, I think that a lot of that is actually happening. I mean, I have some hope because this is a disparate movement, but there is a movement of people, whether they're concerned about economic issues, you know, they're concerned about local, you know, having healthy food or food security, or they're concerned about peak oil, they're concerned about climate change, or they want to rebuild their local economy that's been decimated by Walmarts or, you know, outsourcing. You know, there are lots of reasons why people are motivated, but the results are sort of the same, which is kind of getting to what's fundamental about the things that we value and care about, you know, and that's what resilience is, you know. So there's where I guess I have hope in all of this is that there are a lot of things that we could do on an individual basis, on a community basis. Will they be enough to avoid hardship, avoid shocks, avoid changes? No, they won't be enough, you know. But the best thing that we could do is be, you know, intellectually, psychologically, emotionally prepared, you know.
Okay. So have we reached critical mass on an approaching critical mess? We'll find out. We'll continue our conversation with Asher Miller with the Post Carbon Institute right after this short break. So glad you can stay with us, Asher, because I want to talk a little bit more about what we can and should be doing with this art, with this information. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Very pleased to be bringing you this awful news because, let's face it, it's our reality. We've got to deal with it, and that's half the battle. Once we accept it, we can move forward into solving it and resolving it. As long as we stay in denial, we've got that much longer ahead of us before we turn the tide. And we have to. We have no choice. We have children. We have grandchildren. We have hopes for a better future. So wake up, folks. Keep it tuned to The Green Front on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. Please join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. when we talk about the power of the fork, how our food choices affect our health, the environment, and the treatment of animals. Learn how a plant-based diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds is not only delicious, but gentle on the planet.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
The Progressive Radio Network is the home for progressive minds. It's the place where progressives get together to discuss important topics with informed opinions, minus the agenda. PRN is the place for fresh, stimulating, commercial-free radio content from leading progressives all over the world every day. The Progressive Radio Network, making the world a more informed place, one mind at a time.
Is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there or be square.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Back to the Green Front. I want to go right back to my interview with Cher Miller. I hope you're enjoying it, if you don't mind the kind of bleak forecast. But again, I believe we have to face it first and then get on with figuring out what we're going to do about it. And at the Post Carbon Institute and many other great places like Post Peak Living Institute, we're going to be speaking with the president of that place as well, Andre Angelantoni, next week, because I just find this whole, cut to the chase kind of conversation too important to just do, one short interview. I want to really explore this more deeply. Hope you agree. This is pretty compelling stuff. So a couple of statistics that stand out from the chat that I heard on Saturday, which is what led to my seeking out this conversation with Cher, Ken White with the Post Carbon Institute also was part of the speaking seminar that I attended on Saturday, was this: energy is going to be in in such demand with population and consumption trends across the globe, and especially here in America, where we are only 4% of the world's population and we use 25% of the world's resources, including oil, that's part of the reason why we just cannot, recycle our way out of this, or even that electric cars or solar, wind power, geothermal is not going to. Even if we, turn to it, embraced it wholeheartedly tomorrow, it still won't be enough, because there's a couple of key figures. One is that 40% of all the oil ever burned has been burned since 1960. Is that correct to share? And then also, and this is part of what Richard Heinberg is talking about in his upcoming book, The End of Growth, why economists are getting it wrong. It's the debt factor, that the ratio of debt to GDP is actually astonishing in terms of, how our debt is such that we are not going to be able to just, get jobs going and get the economy going and return to normal. So I've put a lot out there, but you've got about 8 more minutes to address all that.
Sure. Yeah, I think the relationship between energy and economy and the economy is very important for people, I think, to understand. First thing I think that people need to understand about the economy is that the economy is built, our entire financial and monetary system is built on an expectation of growth. When we print money, we put money into the money supply. That's money that's put out with debt. We've got a debt-based currency system. And so when two people enter into a transaction, both of them are basically entering that transaction with a belief that the economy is going to grow, in the sense that if I loan you $100, I expect you to pay me back the $100 with interest. For you to borrow that money, you have to have a belief that you're going to be able to recoup that money and to make a profit on it enough to be able to pay me back and then some, right? And that's entire, I'm giving a very sort of very simplistic description, but that's effectively the way our financial and monetary system is built, And growth, it's a really funny thing to me, because growth is one of those things that somehow, some way, has become so embedded in our belief system as a society that to question it is almost like, somebody, 500 years ago questioning whether the sun revolved around the earth. It's just not done. But the truth of the matter is that, my 4-year-old could probably, when you explain to him, do you think it's possible to keep growing forever and ever? He'd probably tell you no, but that is ultimately what, our economic system, believes. And we're all sort of, our policy systems, everything, we're all sort of bought into that belief system. And we've been able to actually do it. We've had, incredible amount of growth in terms of economic activity, growth across the board. And one of the things that we like to show people is sort of that, kind of hockey chart graph that Al Gore made famous when he's talking about climate. I don't know if you remember in Inconvenient Truth.
Remember, I can't, when I close my eyes, that's all I see at night.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we've got that same trend of exponential growth across the board in all kinds of things, population growth, water consumption, all kinds of things, right? And that's true for economic activity. That's come with a lot of benefits, but it's been done basically, on the back of cheap and abundant energy. And when you look at charts, of energy consumption, the growth of that and growth of GDP, there's a real correlation between the two things. So what happens when our energy supplies, become constrained and go into decline, which is really what peak oil is about? This idea that when you've hit a peak in production, you still have a lot of the stuff left. It doesn't mean that your, gas tank is empty. It just means that for, every barrel that you, of oil that you're able to produce, you're, losing more than one, right? And what are the impacts of that? When our economy is predicated on needing more and more of it, in order to function, there's going to be a growing gap there. There's a delta there, and how do we deal with that? And I think a lot of people feel like we're going to deal with that by bringing renewable energy online. And it's true that the energy of the future will be renewable because we simply don't have a choice. Fossil fuels are a non-renewable source of energy. One way or the other, we're going to deplete them to the point where they're not economically feasible or physically feasible to continue to produce. You know, so the energy of the future, you know, is going to be renewable. But can it completely make up one to one not only the energy that we currently consume in fossil fuels, but also the energy that everyone expects us to consume in terms of demand with world population increases and economic growth? And unfortunately, our conclusion is that we won't. We really won't. Renewables can't fill that gap and continue to allow the economy and demand to grow.
And it's not like we're doing everything in our power right now. You don't see the government, you know, subsidizing solar panels to be, you know, nailed onto every roof and every warehouse, every naked roof out there at all. I mean, we have politics, and we have a lot of forces going against this. Obviously, the, you know, status quo, the oil and auto industry, auto industry until recently, they're finally, you know, waking up and seeing the green light. But, you know, even if we really got on board, it's still not enough, and we're not getting on board fast enough. So I guess that's the next step that I wonder about. You know, what can we do in terms of education and outreach to really at least, you know, awaken the slumbering masses so at least they cannot claim ignorance and, and stop the garbage that's going on playing politics with the planet?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, ultimately that's where it all comes down to. You know, there are a lot of things that we need to work on. There are a lot of people working on different aspects of this front, right? But the fundamental core thing, you know, that we're concerned about is that in terms of the narrative that out there, that the conversation that we're having with one another and you know, as a people, is that what we're dealing here with are fundamental limits, you know, and I think, you know, thinking about it in terms of sort of a metaphor, you know, the metaphor I like to think of in my own mind is that we're sort of lottery winners. We won a lottery when we found fossil fuels. We figured out how to use them, you know, and that was an amazing gift. And we kind of went crazy with it, you know. We've been able to do a lot of wonderful things with it, you know, like a lottery winner can buy a really nice home, maybe buy nice cars and do other things.
And now we're having a carbon hangover right now.
Right. Well, and what we end up with is having a lifestyle that's dependent upon it, you know, and so what we're being forced to look at is, one, are, you know, what are the debts that we've accrued, you know, kind of going nuts, you know, with this, with these winnings that we found, you know, and how do we pay those debts off? And that's, you know, climate change and other, you know, ecological legacies that we're going to have to deal with, and not to mention all the issues in terms of equity, between haves and have-nots and such, but also how do we learn to live within our means, you know? And it's important for people to understand we still have a lot of resources there, you know, but we're dealing with needing to live on a budget, you know, and I think people can relate to that.
People can, but what do you say to this, since you are so wise and this is your work again, what wonderful and disturbing work it must be, the you know, two sides of the coin there, having this awareness all the time. What Colin Bevan and No Impact Man and others talk about is, well, if we really do stop feeling like we need, you know, 10 new clothing items per month, whatever the average American buys, or new shoes and, you know, new gadgets galore, what is that going to do to, you know, all the people, mostly in China, you know, factories making these things that we are seemingly keeping our economy going, you know, based on our overconsumptiveness?
That's the rub. You know, it's really a tricky situation because, like I was saying, our economy, our globalized economy, is predicated on consumption. 70% of our economy is based upon consumer spending, right?
And a lot on things we really, let's face it, don't need maybe don't even want. You know, we shop in the store here. You go and you own a store, you didn't. And I'm guilty of this, too. I've just recently pulled myself off and just said, if I don't go into the store, I'll never suddenly fall in love with something I think I want. And yet, if we all did that, what happens to our economy? So I guess that's where the rubber does meet the road.
Right.
Is it possible
if we all
for us
stopped,
to survive?
The economy, of course, the economy would, you know, the economy would blow up, you know, and that is the rub, you know. But we're not talking about, I mean, there's a lot of economic activity that we're going to continue to have. You know, one of the things that we talk about and work on, for example, are, you know, is import substitution. You know what I mean? And so some of the things that people can focus on and look at doing is, as I mentioned before, is building individual and community resilience, right? So one way of doing that is supporting the, you know, and investing in a local food system, you know, and procurement of local services and goods. And much of our economy is built around, and I will talk about, I'm happy to talk about sort of the whole social justice aspect in terms of development, the people in China and others that we promised, you know, better standard of living in a second if you want. But when it comes down to in terms of the well-being and security of ourselves and our own communities, one of the places we can start right now is not stopping buying anything, you know what I mean, but thinking about what are we choosing to buy, you know, and where is it coming from, you know. And I think we're going to actually see a renaissance in terms of economic activity on the local level because as we're dealing with constraints and maybe there aren't going to be quite the availability of things that we're used to getting all the time, you know, there's going to be a prolific reemergence of all kinds of things, you know. And we live in an area where there's a lot of focus on local food production. We're lucky to, you know, but we're seeing that in other places as well, even in urban communities. And that's an area where, you know, groups like the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies and Slow Money and, you know, groups like ours and the transition movement are really focused on, you know, is trying to rebuild that local economy. So it doesn't have to be saying, okay, well, we either bought into this consumer-based, globalized economic system and we all have to keep it going or else, you know, the whole train's going to crash. Or, you know, we stop and if we all stop at once, then, you know, then all hell breaks loose. There's a lot in between that.
It's about conscious consumption. And if you have just a couple more minutes, I'm aware that it's time. You said you had to leave us, but I'd love to hear your take on the social justice issue. And then just make sure you give us your website so people can start with watching that brilliant five-minute video that will very graphically make an impression on anyone who sees it.
Sure. Well, you know, the issue about social justice and development, you know, this is a tricky one because I think that when we think about development, international development in particular, you know, a lot of that, the international development work, which is coming from the right, completely the right motivation, is also, you know, bought into this belief that we can grow, you know, we can grow the economy to such a point that it will lift all boats, right? And we just have to be real, you know, we have to be real that we can't continue to do that in perpetuity, you know. So when we think about development and providing opportunities, I do not want to be overly simplistic here and naive to say that, oh, look, you know, developing, quote-unquote developing communities are actually going to be in better position, you know, to deal with a world of constraints because they know how to live with less and all those things. There's a level of that that's true in the sense that I think psychologically it's going to be a bigger adjustment for us. You know what I mean? Then the communities that have had to learn how to provide for themselves and to live more simply. That is true. You know, I'm not going to be so naive to say that, you know, there's some rosy picture of how communities in Africa and other places, when we can't continue to provide, you know, income for their communities by, you know, having them produce our T-shirts, you know, for example. You know, I think that there are other things that we can focus on in terms of development. And what we want to make sure about, and this is what I was saying before, you know, what are the key things that people need to come away with, is understanding that we're dealing with fundamental limits that are not the fault of Obama or McCain or whoever. I mean, there are lots of things that on the political front that are important and that choices that we make there make a huge difference. But it doesn't matter who's in office. These are fundamental limits that we're dealing with here. So we need to be really wary of scapegoating anybody.
And you know, we waste so much time with a political pendulum swinging back and forth, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like and this is why, I mean, I'm not advocating for a despotic regime like China, but in some ways China is more able than we are to make long-term decisions because they're not worried about a two-year or four-year election cycle, you know. But that's the reality that we are dealing with here, you know. But I think it's just important to realize there's a lot of stake there. People should be engaged civically, absolutely. But this is not a simple matter of, oh, if it was this person in office and this person wasn't in office, everything would be better, you know, or if, the, you know, there weren't so many illegal immigrants coming into the country, everything would be better. I mean, these are all real issues, but to say that it's one person or one, you know, one ethnicity group's fault is a real danger. We're very concerned about that, you know.
I agree. I just would love to see a sort of a green Apollo project. I'd love to see all these, you know, unemployed or underemployed people hired to, you know, educate and do outreach and let everybody know, you know, what's at stake and what we can do. That emergency situation that we're not quite feeling yet.
Yeah, and there is a lot of Apollo stuff that we can do. It's just not necessarily, it's not limited to the stuff that Obama talked about in the State of the Union address, for example. You know what I mean?
Right, and he mentioned climate change.
Right, climate change and also called coal queen, you know.
Right.
So, but in any case, yeah, I'm afraid I have to run. The website address is postcarbon.org. And our video, the animation that you were talking about, I think I'm going to try to pull up our website really fast. I think you can see it at the top right of the website.
You can YouTube it. It's put the title of it in, which is fossil fuel 300 seconds, 300 years.
300 years of fossil fuels in 300 seconds. So if people if they just Google 300 years of fossil fuels, they'll be able to pull
it up. It's excellent, and who doesn't have 5 minutes to look at what we're facing in our future if we don't wake up and smell the CO2? Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Cher Miller, Executive Director of the Post-Carbon Institute. We're going to be hearing a lot more from them, my new favorite group. They're just up the road here in Marin and Sonoma counties, but you can access them online, and you can access us online. If you're just joining us, you want to hear the beginning of that interview and speaking with Cher Miller this entire hour, you can go to my website, which is www.thegreenfront.com, and just going to give you a little preview of what's coming up next week, because I said that the presentations I saw over the weekend just blew my mind. Andre Angelantoni is going to be with us. He's with Post Peak Living Institute, and he is working on a video as well. I don't think it's 5 minutes, but it is just as dramatic and very graphic in terms of looking at trends of our fossil fuel discovery and use, and looking at our debt, how the debt is going to come up and bite us in the butt, not just talking about, you know, America's debt, but just the debt we have to nature and what we've been using with seeming abandon, and how the costs of that are just now beginning to be felt. It is disturbing. It is pretty dire, but it is important to be aware of what's going on. I think you'll agree, and hope you will tell your friends about this program and also this great network, the Progressive Radio Network. In the meantime, I want to wish you a happy Valentine's Day. I was going to be doing some Green Valentine tips. But I think we devoted too much time to something a little more important than that. So I trust that you'll have a great green-red Valentine Day. In the meantime, I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Thanks for joining us. Please email me. Let me know what you think of my programming. I am the host and producer and chief marketer, better at getting great green guests on. I think you'll agree. Not so good at promoting my show, so I need to ask you to help. Please put it out there on Facebook and Twitter. The Green Front, I've been doing reporting on the environmental scene for 13, 14 years now, so I do have a lot of great connections in the environmental community. The community, of course, keeps growing with more and more people becoming aware that this is an area that needs a lot of us to address, and hopefully more of us will be able to make a living doing environmental outreach, education, really consciousness raising. That's what it's about. But it's not just about talking, it's about getting into action. But we must first understand what we're facing. We can only save what we know and what we love, and that's our planet, our life support system, nature. We, of course, being part of Mother Nature, an integral part of it, and of course needing to protect our planet and our home and our place. Thanks for joining me. See you next time. We just come together. We can